Thank you, Sam, for asking me, and thanks to see all of you here on this day and for sharing this time with me. First thing, I stand before you an alcoholic, first and foremost. I am an alcoholic. Now I have a name, Rich Dykes. Comes in that order for me. I have a sobriety date. I believe I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. And by that, I mean several things. One, I have a sobriety date, September 15th, 1974. That's what's in this book. In my first book, it says 16 September, but anyway, one of those days. I've been celebrating the 15th for a long time. I know my last drunk was on Labor Day pool party. That much I know. More about that a little bit later. So, I'm a sober alcoholic. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. I sponsor people. And I do service work. And so I believe all that makes me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. An old friend of mine who passed away recently, Brother Alexis, and used to say, I stand before you a phenomenon. That word's in the front of this book. And that is a sober alcoholic. And he describes phenomenon, and I just love it. His explanation, and nothing I say is original, so if I forget to give credit or don't know who said it, somebody said it before me. I just picked up a lot of stuff. And he said, you know, I'm a sober alcoholic, and that's a phenomenon. A phenomenon is really defined as a rare occurrence in nature. So I'll explain that the way he did. If you see a cow grazing in its field, chewing its cud, that's not a phenomenon. If you see a thistle growing in that field, that's not a phenomenon. If you see a bird sitting on a fence post singing a beautiful song, that's not a phenomenon. But if you see a cow sitting on a thistle singing like a bird, that is a phenomenon. And so, yes, my nature is to be drunk. That's my nature. But I was born in February 16th, 1945, so I'm 68 years old. I know I only look 39, but, you know, I am 68. And I've got 38 years, September 15th, so you don't have to do the math. I've got 38 years, and this September will be 39 years of continuous sobriety. I'm a happy alcoholic today. I hope you all are happy. I really do. I say today I have a life second to none. And my wife, she's asked me for since I've been saying it, I heard this down in Georgia, you know, well, why wouldn't you say you just have a first-class life? Wouldn't that be okay? And I said, well, I said, I could look at it that way. I said, but you know, my thinking, my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my envy, my all those things, I said, I see Joe over there with a beautiful young hottie, and I might think he has a really first-class life, and I might think like that. But when I say I have a life second to none, I don't have to look at that. I don't have to think about the gazillionaires with their money. I don't have to think about that. I have a life second to none today. And that's a result of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly owe God and AA my life and everything I have in it. They told me when I came into AA that sometime you'll hear your story. And so I got my story, you know, you'll get it. It's the only one I know. It's changed from maybe when I came in. It's changed midstream. A lot of things have changed with some growth. And I'm a slow learner. I grow slow. I was one of these kids, and I don't believe my mother bore me to be an alcoholic. And I happen to have a terminal kidney disease, which you can't really tell. And I'll talk a little bit about that. I don't think she bore me to have a terminal kidney disease either. But I got both of them. And she, bless her soul, I'm number two. And number one didn't get sober until about 7 years ago. So, He did it. It's not his story, but he didn't use AA. He knew I was in it. He's known it all his life. He's gone through a number of families and problems. He ended up in the hospital. His liver burst and he almost died, and that's why he quit drinking. And he hasn't had a drink since. He's on wife number four, and they're happy, and we get along. So he was number one, and I was number two. And my poor mother didn't know what to do with us because we were not normal. I was never normal, ever. I like to say I spent 29 years of my life miserable, suicidal, and depressed. I don't remember happiness as a child. I just don't remember it. I blanked out my childhood. I don't hear a lot of people that talk about how much their childhood was completely... It was in the last grapevine was an article about a guy who did that. I mean, truly, I was so full of self, I was not going to do anything that anybody told me to do, whether it was my parents, whether it was the school, whether it was peers. I was not going to do it. And so that's the way I was. That was my mental state, and that's all I can remember in my early childhood. It didn't really come to pass that I identified what happened to me when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, but I was raped. It wasn't somebody in my family. Don't know for sure who it was. Doesn't matter. I was a pretty young kid. That probably had a lot to do with me blanking out a lot of my childhood. Doesn't matter. Didn't make me an alcoholic. None of this made me an alcoholic. But I can tell you this. So I didn't get along in school. I didn't get along with my peers. I didn't get along with my parents. I didn't get along with my brothers and sisters. I didn't get along with anybody. Somewhere around 8 years old, and, you know, only an alcoholic can go back, I'm 68, so 60 years ago, and picture the coffee table in the living room where my dad and my granddad kept the bottles of whiskey. And I know what brand it was. I know what brand. It was Four Roses or Three Feathers, you know, cheap whiskey. And they liked to drink shots and beer chasers. And sometime around 8 years old, I went in that coffee table, I opened it up, and I took that bottle out, and I took a big swig of that whiskey bottle. Now, I hear a lot of people talk up here and remember all the things that happened when they did their first drink. I only remember one thing. I felt a warm glow go all the way down to my bottom of my toes. I knew I now had friends. Everything was okay. I don't remember the burning. I'm sure it did. I don't remember whether I blacked out, passed out. I don't remember. But I knew from that moment on, I never drank socially, ever. My social drinking is, I'll have a drink, so shall I. Bring two at a time. I need more. Now, I didn't just go, boom, I'm off to the races. I don't know how much I drank. I can remember being about 10 years old and going to a family gathering, 10, 11 years old, and I hung around a beer keg. And we were a little bit of a couple hours drive away, and I'm sick in the back seat on the way back, and my mother saying, what's wrong with him? And my dad saying, well, he just ate too much, you know. I was drunk, and I was sick as a dog. I vaguely remember being down by the railroad tracks one time with some bums in the boxcars drinking. We could always get beer. By the time I was 15, trying to speed this trunk log up, by the time I was 15, I was drinking regularly, any chance I got. By the time I was 16, I had a phony ID card that said I was 18 because that was the legal age in New York. Now, I didn't have to drink every day back then. But what I did have to do is, and this was $20 was a lot of money in the 60s. If I did not have $20 in my pocket, I did not start drinking. I didn't have enough money to get drunk enough. I was a blackout drinker. I drove in blackouts. I puking drinker, puking out the side of the car. I'd drive into New York City. I live 30 miles north of New York City. I'd drink in New York City. I'd drive home. I'd come to out of a blackout 30 miles north of where I lived, and somehow I'd get home. But that's the kind of drunk I was. I was a blackout, puking, drunk drinker. And I never seemed to fit in. I was not one of these drinkers that, oh man, this didn't make me boisterous and feel good. It made me crawl deeper into my shell. That's just what it did for me. It made me fall deeper into my shell. So, somehow, now, you know, I've talked to several people. A lot of people flunk second grade or third grade. Some flunk eighth or ninth grade. Nobody flunked fifth grade. But I did. I flunked fifth grade. Not only did I flunk fifth grade, I just tuned out. I flunked sixth grade. You know, I still didn't learn. But somehow I finished high school. And, you know, I used to think, I'll back up real quick. When I was 11 years old, another major instance in my life was, I remember coming home to my parents and saying, I'm not going back to church. There is no God. I'm done with God. I don't believe in God. Mainly because of myself, because I was in myself. It can't be a God. It's all about me. So I didn't believe in God. It talks in the book about belligerent denial. If you were going to have a discussion about a God with me, I was full of belligerent denial. Anyway, I managed to graduate high school, and a couple things happened. When I was 15, God really looked out for me. I didn't recognize this till years later in AA. But when I was 15, and my older brother was 17, and he was given a choice of going to jail or go to service, and I'm thinking to myself, self, you're lucky. That's all that's going to happen to you in 2 years, because you're 10 times worse than he is. And all of a sudden, I started doing work in school. I got up to honorable mention instead of flunking out. Almost made the honor roll, and I brought my grades up, and I wanted to finish school. So other than drinking on weekends, I got through that. I managed to graduate. They were amazed at two things in my high school. A, that I graduated, and B, that I wasn't in jail, because I should have been in both places. So after that, I got married. I went to two-year college, community college. The first time I quit drinking, I was about 16 and a half, 17 years old. I knew alcohol was my problem. If any of you are old enough and remember the movie Days of Wine and Roses, I saw that movie when I was 17, when it first came out. Now, I should have been watching James Bond and all this other stuff, but, you know, again, somebody up there put me in that movie theater. And I knew that that was me. I knew then that I was that type of alcoholic. I knew that. And so when I went to community college, I'd already tried quitting drinking back when I was 17. That only lasted a couple months. And after that, I didn't worry about it. But when I went to community college, I set out to control my drinking. I was not going to drink during the week. I was going to study, and I not drank during the week. And I did that for 2 years. But my low self-esteem, low self-worth, my attitude, I flunked a required course. I got a 3.2 grade point average and didn't graduate because I flunked a required course. That's the story of my life. I almost get up there and then I got to fall down. Beat myself up. I can't succeed. I'd been beat down my whole life and I couldn't succeed. I had this fear of success. Anyway, I finished that. The draft is coming around, and something told me to get married, and whatever possessed me to get married that time around, that lasted 7 years, and that was over. And my drinking had a lot to play in that. I was certainly a large part of that problem. Got married, and my drinking then was I'd go to the bar every night after work, and I didn't know what time I'd get home. Draft came around, go to basic training, and basic training, back then, they only served 3.2 beer on the base. That was half the normal alcohol of regular beer. And, of course, we were restricted, but as soon as we were supposed to be in our study time, I'd sneak out of the barracks and I'd go up to beer hall. And I'd get a beer, top off it, and I'd get two. Tell them to leave the top on, and I'd put them in my pants or pockets, fatigue pockets, and coat. And so we had 2 hours. I had to be back for bed check. So I'd drink as much as I could, and then I'd have pockets full of beer, and I'd run back to the barracks, and I'd go down to the boiler room where it's cold. It was February, wintertime, and I'd put them down against the wall, and I'd go back up for bed check, and I'd go run down there, and I'd finish my beer. And I did that almost every night. Now, there was a guy next to me in formation, so same first letters of the last name. I'll never forget this guy because he took canned Sterno and strained the alcohol out and drank it. He had a problem. I remember thinking, this guy's got a real problem with alcohol. I didn't think I had a problem. Nothing wrong with what I did, but it takes a lot of 3.2 beer to get a buzz on. But I finished basic training, went to advanced training. I signed up for officer school. And where they read, we think we can drink like a gentleman. Now, this is my story. I swear I didn't drink for 6 months while I was in the restricted environment of OCS. I did meet one of my classmates later on. He said, yes, I did. But that's his story. I don't know what I did. I did not think I drank. We had Sunday afternoon that we could get off, you know, out of our barracks confined area. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't know. Doesn't matter. But I do know this. After 6 months, and I remember, I didn't drink, I had a piece of paper from Congress that said, you are now an officer and a gentleman. You are commissioned a lieutenant in the United States Army. I almost got thrown out of OCS, almost, for an honor code violation that was overturned. It's a long story. But again, almost didn't make it. Story of my life. But now I have a piece of paper that says, you are an officer and a gentleman. And now, I used to drink the cheapest beer I could buy and the cheapest whiskey. But I'm making a little money now. And somehow I knew that gentlemen drank Michelob beer. Who remembers what they drank that long ago? But gentlemen drank Michelob beer. So now I got to go off base, my wife's off base, and I buy a six-pack of Michelob. And I had two beers with dinner. That's good. I can do this. See, I'm an officer and a gentleman. I can do this. I can control my drinking. The next day, I bought a case and drank the whole case. That's the story of my beer. So now you get the picture. I go to Vietnam, I become a pilot, I finish that, again, trying to control it, but I become a pilot in the Army, helicopter pilot, and I was a totally wasted drunk in Vietnam. I mean, completely wasted. I could not function. I got relieved from several jobs, bad efficiency reports, and drinking was a real problem. You know, I heard a speaker, when in Vietnam, everybody got promoted, and I remember the colonel when he promoted me to captain, and I can remember this look of utter disgust when he said, I don't know why I'm doing this. I was that kind of failure. I was a worthless drunk. I got back from Vietnam, and I went to Germany. And that time in my life is quite instructive for me, because this was 1970 when I got over there, and I got out of the Army in 73. And what happened in Germany was several things. One, first of all, I straightened up my act pretty good, and I was able to control my drinking pretty good, and I was able to function pretty well in my job. And so my first job, I was a logistics officer, and I did that for 18 months. And then they gave me command of a company. And there were 200 people in that company. And as a commander in the military, over in Germany in the 70s, probably 30% of that company that lived in the barracks were heavy drug abusers. Another 30% were heavy booze drinkers. Some of them alcoholics, some not, but they were certainly heavy drinkers and a lot of drug addicts. And at that time, the Army did a lot of classes on drug addiction, alcoholism. So I learned a lot about alcoholism. And I learned about drug addiction. Not only did I learn from the classroom stuff and from people who talked, but I also learned from having to deal with, as a supervisor, a large part of the company abusing drugs and alcohol. I'll say real quickly about drugs. Drugs are part of most people's stories in AA. And I'm a dinosaur in AA. I am a pure alcoholic. I have never smoked pot, never inhaled it. But I got to tell you a little bit about why when I was a teenager. I was so afraid of drugs because I knew how bad my drinking was and my thinking was. I was so afraid of drugs that I was deathly afraid of even getting into them. When I got into the Army and became an officer, I was in a different crowd. So I didn't use drugs only because they weren't in my scheme of things back then. It doesn't mean, and these old-timers, when I got into AA, they said, do not take a drink or a mood-changing drug. The marijuana maintenance program does not work, and I believed them. And I think that's extremely important for us to know. This is AA, but most people have drugs in their story. And it's in my story, but in a different way. I was deathly afraid of them as a teenager. And then when I got over there and I learned about drugs and alcohol and I dealt with people who... And back then, they kind of separated the two. The drug addicts and the alcoholics did not mix. Not that they didn't do both, but they really didn't mix, especially the drug. The pure alcoholics, they just drank. The guys who did drugs, they also drank. And I observed that the drunks would show up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, be out in formation, they'd work their tail off. They might not have got in until 3 in the morning. I knew if a guy was a drug addict within 2 weeks because he'd be laying in bed. Oh, you're picking on me, man. I'm not going out there. They have a whole different attitude, psychological attitude. And so it really affects judgment, and I watched that. But anyway, back to me. I had a boss, and he drank a fifth of liquor a day. Started off his morning with half a canteen cup of coffee and scotch. But he asked me over his house one night. And he got out the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he showed me chapter 5, how it works. And he said, Rich, if you keep going the way you're going, you're going to be right where I am. And inside, I'm if I ever get that bad, I'll really do something. And he's still drinking. And I know that. I'm a spy officer. I'm buying his booze. He did finally get sober several years after me. He got medically retired from the Army, lost both feet in a car accident. But I bring that up because it's important. He took the time to talk to me, and he planted a seed. I had another guy who worked for me who came to me and said, sir, I got a problem with drinking. I need help. Now, what I did then, not knowing much about AA, I called AA for him, and we're over in Germany, and he happened to be what we call a charge of quarters. He was sitting in the stairwell to monitor people coming in all night, and I'm up in my office, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm watching these two guys come up, and they wore suits back then. They're coming to talk to him, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, God, I hope they don't see me. They'll recognize they need to talk to me, too, because I knew I was screwed up. Yeah, I knew I was one of you guys. But I could do it myself. I had knowledge now, and I had willpower. You see, I'd finished OCS. I'd finished flight school. I had willpower. I learned I could do anything. And I had knowledge. Now, I've studied drugs and alcohol. One of the things I read is if you, by your own definition or by the definition of your family and friends, think you have a problem with alcohol, then you do. My wife thought I had a problem. My boss thought I had a problem. And I thought I had a problem. And you know what? I dealt with troops. Three strikes, you're out. God's talking. I quit drinking. I got laid off from the Army. Vietnam wound down, 73. Lots of people got laid. Pink slip. They call it a reduction in force. Got laid off. Went back to school, spent the loneliest year of my life. Got divorced. Went back to school, spent the loneliest year of my life. That didn't work. And I had quit drinking in that last 3 or 4 years, probably 1,000 times. You know, if you're an alcoholic like I am, some people come in the doors of AA and they stay sober from the time they get in. I'm one of them. But that's only because I was ready. I was absolutely ready. And I had 1,000 slips or relapses before I got to AA. I didn't need to go test that theory. I had enough. I had this loneliest year of my life, and I took a geographical cure. I got a job down in Maryland, so I left New York. I was going to school in New York, and I went down to Maryland. And I went to a Labor Day pool party at this apartment complex I lived in, and I was playing some touch football, jumped up in the air, and I came down, and my knee was locked up 90 degrees, and I couldn't move it. So I'm on crutches. Now my family is up in New York. Nothing but me and my four walls and my apartment full of booze. All right? You know, if you're like me, you probably had lots of things. If I ever drove my motorcycle drunk, I'll give up drinking. I had a motorcycle, and I drove it down Route 50, drunk a couple times, and trucks beeping their horns at me. You know, I did all this stuff. One time, I was in France when I was over in Germany, and I had a Volkswagen camper. I got my wife and baby in the car, and I'm in Paris, France, on leave. It's dark. Now, I can only imagine what she was going through, because she had to be screaming at me. I was in a blackout. I'm going the wrong way around a one-way circle right in the middle of downtown Paris, France, with all the lights go out. And I'm in a blackout. And I come out of this blackout, and I go, oh, my God, that's the kind of drunk I was. So I guess you get the picture. Drinking didn't work for me. So anyway, I get laid off. I come down this geographical cure, and there's me and my four walls. And I always said, you know, if I drank in the morning, I drank in the morning. You know, I could go a few days without drinking. You know, it was hard. I could go a few days without drinking. I had to take a flight physical. I was in the National Guard. And I tried to go 2 weeks without drinking, and I couldn't do it. I did go 4 days before that flight physical. I was before this pool party drunk. I managed to go 4 days. That's all I could do. So, anyway, I'm on crutches now from my last drunk. And I don't believe in God. I got no place to turn. And I got me and my four walls and all the booze. I always had money. I always had money for booze. After being in the Army, becoming an officer, I always had money for booze. I always had a well-stocked cabinet. And I'd say, well, I'll just have lunch. It's 10 a.m. I'll have lunch, so I can have a beer with lunch. That's, you know, that's where I ended up. So I ended up on crutches. No health insurance yet. Credit cards maxed out. Divorced. You know, I try to paint that picture because 38 years, I have so much in my life today. But I came in just like everybody else comes in. On crutches, in debt up to my elbows. Credit cards maxed out. I paid for that operation. I paid the doctor bills. I did all that. I moved the first three times I was in AA. I moved 3 years in a row. As soon as the lease was up, I moved to a cheaper place, to a cheaper place, to a cheaper place, because I started getting responsible. They told me to get responsible and pay the debts off. And I paid the debts. I paid the doctor bill, the hospital bill. And, of course, I paid my child support. So I'm in this four walls, and I quit drinking. And this is just the way it worked for me. I quit drinking. It was in the afternoon, 5 or 6 o'clock. Still doing it on my own. I go 24 hours without a drink. And I got the mild VTs. I got some chafe. My stomach's hurting. My head's hurting. And I want a drink. But instead of taking a drink, I got on my knees in that room. And I said, God, just get me through tonight. And I felt this peace that's been with me ever since. I felt this peace come through me and through this room. And I knew at that moment that there was a God and it was going to be okay. Now, God wasn't done with me yet. See, because the next morning, I went into a deep sleep. And we were talking, me and another guy were talking, you know, we don't sleep well. These last drugs, we don't sleep well at all. We don't sleep well when we come into AA. But I went into a deep sleep, and I slept 12, 13, 14 hours. And when I got up the next morning, I got the phone book out, and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. And back then we had dial telephones, and they answered down at the intergroup office, and a guy called me back. And from that day to this, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-changing drug, and for that I'm very grateful. Now, you know, these old-timers, they said, you know, if a drunken horse thief comes into AA and quits drinking, what are you left with? A horse thief. Now, see, all this stuff in my makeup, the lying, I was a liar, a thief, and a drunk, not necessarily in that order. I was lying since I was old enough to remember. I lied about everything, and I stole. I stole candy bars out the thing. I ate sugar. I don't know, you know, I heard another guy talk about this. That sugar bowl that sat on the dining room table, we didn't have a dining room kitchen table, I'd go by and eat the spoonfuls of sugar. I mean, I did that when I was growing up. If I got candy bars, I ate anything. I'd steal them and eat them. I got to have sugar. I craved sugar my whole life. I still do. I'm losing my train of thought. Oh, I'm blank. Anyway, the stealing. I had a job. I took a geographic tour and I got a job, man. And I was in a management job. And I got fired a year sober for stealing from that job. And I share that with everybody. It's important. We don't get all that well overnight. I'm still learning things today. Enjoy this ride. I made a couple deals with God. I really, you know, the first three steps, I just had to look at unmanageability. I'm on crutches, I described all, you know, I'm in debt up front, you know, it's unmanageable. Okay? Being restored to sanity. Well, I mean, way back when I was a kid, and I used to ride by the state mental hospital on my bicycle, I thought I belonged in there, and that was before I even drank that much. I mean, I was crazy. I knew I was crazy. And they told me that in school. A school psychologist said, you're suicidal and depressed. And yeah, you're all wet, lady. I'm going to talk to you. I blank all that out. So I knew I was crazy. But restored to sanity in AA means I don't have to drink anymore. I don't have to make that decision to pick up a drink. I have some soundness of mind. Some soundness. My thinking still is screwed up. Today, sometimes. It's a lot better than it was. But, you know, the soundness of mind, the insanity they talk about in the book is that thought of picking up a drink. The delusion, we were talking about that earlier. No place in this book does it say denial. No place in here. I believed every time I quit drinking or said I'm only going to have one or whatever it was, I believed in my innermost gut that I could stop drinking or I would only have one or two and I would do that. I believed my own bullshit. That's delusional. That's not denial. That is not denial. That's delusional. So step one and two and three came pretty easy, you know, to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, as we understood him. And because I had that, I just believe God in his ultimate wisdom knew if I didn't have that, I was so full of belligerent denial, I honestly believe that if I'd walked into an AA meeting and we held hands and said the Lord's Prayer at the end of that meeting, if that had not happened to me, I would not be here today. I'm not sure I'd be here today. I needed that. I had to have it or I wouldn't be here. So that's steps one, two, and three. By the way, I believe, this is just my own belief, that none of us get to AA except that somebody else was praying for us. I do not believe I got a chair in AA that somebody else wasn't praying for us. So when I go back and I think of my aunt and my godmother, and I called my aunt a couple of Mother's Days ago, and I said, she's Catholic, and I said, you know, I want to thank you, because I know you always prayed for me when I was growing up. And she says, I still am. She does her rosary every night, you know, and she's got her list of people she prays for. And there's more. You know, there was neighbors and there's other people. I don't know if my parents were into prayer or not, but people were praying for me. And my personal opinion is none of us get here that somebody wasn't praying for us. You know, the next thing I hear a lot around AA today is, well, AA taught me to love myself. That's not what the old-timers told me. They're nowhere in here. In fact, in the meditation book I read, the old-time meditation book before the politically correct one came out, the one that we had from 1950 to 91, and it talked about that my problem was I loved myself so much. All of this about self. That's loving myself. There's no love of myself in AA. That's not what the old-timers told me. If you look at steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, it's to find my faults and my makeup and my character that cause me problems. And what they told me was when I accept myself as I am, then I can change. It's about acceptance. Love, to me, has to be giving to somebody else, expecting nothing in return. I can't use that definition and say, well, I learned to love myself. You know, self is what got me here. Talked about that in the book. Selfishness and self-centeredness. There, you know, love is to be given away. You know, it's to be given away. It's not about me learning to love myself. And this was before the story back in the book about acceptance. What a great paragraph that is. See, that wasn't in the old book, but the old-timer said that, you know. He must have heard that from the old-timer. It's about acceptance. It's about accepting myself. So steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, that house cleaning. And, you know, I did it to the best of my ability when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But things always come up later on, and that's okay. That's okay. Character defects, it wasn't until I moved to Culpeper in 2001. You know, another thing, these old-timers, they tried to encourage me to go on a spiritual retreat put on by AA members. And I have to talk about step 4 real quick. Step 4, it says we list people, institutions, and principles. And when I did step 4 the first time I came into AA, I only did people. I had a resentment against the church. It took me 28 years in AA before I set foot in the church. So when I talk to people today, I point out, when we go through step 4, that you have to look at institutions. You don't have to go back to church. Not what it says. Not what it's about. But you have to look at the institutions that you have problems with. And you have to look at the principles that you have problems with. Whether it's authority, whether it's honesty. And there's all kinds of principles in there. So a lot of my growth process, I did it to the best of my ability when I came into AA. I did a solid step with a sponsor. I had a great sponsor. He died, I was only a couple years sober when he died of sudden death. He had an aneurysm. He's 57 years old. But we went through the book and we went through the steps. Character defects. And the reason I brought up the retreats is when I finally opened up and I went on a retreat, and it just happened before this retreat, they were talking about being willing to be rid of all these defects of character. And it was only then that it really hit me what that step means. And that's okay. One of the things I learned in AA in this journey in life is, and my first sponsor said this, you know, we make decisions based on what we know today and make the best decision we can. And not to decide is to decide. That's okay. Or if I make a decision and it's wrong, I do my best to fix it later on because I did the best I knew how to do at that time. And that's all I can do. And so I really had to learn not to beat myself up over, you know, I'm going to fail, I'm this is bad, this is this and that. Because if I beat myself up or I get it up in my head, I'm going to want my old solution, which is pick up a drink. That's my old solution. So the journey or the growth process is ongoing. It is ongoing. I've been married now to the same woman for 34 years. We just celebrated 34 years of marriage. And a lot of that, she's never seen me drink. I told her, one of the other things these old-timers told me in this old meditation book was to read January 6th, and I've added January 7th now. There's two right back to back. And why they're important, and why they told me to read that, it says, the most important decision I have ever made in my life was that decision to stay sober. Nothing comes before that decision. They said, you read January 6th every day, then you go to today's date. And we hear this today. Anything you put in front of AA, you're going to lose. And I told my wife when I was getting married to her, this is kind of a funny story. You know, first of all, I told her all about my past. You know, I really, in my perception of my mind, you know, I'm still a liar. I probably left some things out. But I thought I told her everything. You know, told her all about me. And then we were married a short while, and they asked me to speak at College Park over in Maryland. And she was there. We used to go to Saturday night speaker meeting. And I got done condensing my whole story in this short one-hour block. And she said to me, it's a true story, she said, if I'd known that, I never would have married you. But we're still married. The other thing I told her is, and I told her several things. One, you will not come between me and God and Alcoholics Anonymous. That is first in my life. And she's always been supportive. I mean, she's a good woman. doesn't understand it. She still doesn't understand it. She says, I don't understand. You can't expect somebody to understand. They do not know what this mental and physical allergy of alcohol is in this 7 or 10% of the population, whatever you look at it is. I said, I didn't believe my mother bore me to be one, but I am one. And I told her I'd marry her for one day. We're still married, one day at a time. You know? And she understood what I meant. And she did it anyway. So, you know, this program works in a lot of our lives. I said I had a kidney disease that manifested itself when I was in my 40s. By the time I was approaching 60, I was ready to be on dialysis. And, you know, the doctors tell me that dialysis is a solution. The best solution is a transplant. I had 13 people offer me a kidney. If I was a drunk, that never would have been. My older brother, who just quit drinking a few years ago, from his first marriage, I hadn't seen those kids in 32 years, and one of my nieces gave me a kidney. She was number 13. She was the first one to pass all the testing and all that. So I have a kidney. And the doctors told me that I need to take a 3-pack of drugs, and then I'm mood changing. I need to take a very low dose of a steroid and two drugs that knock my immune system down. And I got to thinking here recently, you know, AA just tells me, we have meetings in AA. Now, I can tell you, if meetings, and you hear meeting makers make it and all that's good, I believe in meetings. First of all, nobody has walked between my couch and my TV saying, will you sponsor me? So I got to be out. We have a fellowship and we have meetings. But if meetings kept people sober, everybody living under the bridge in Culpeper would be sober. They have meetings all day long. You know? It's only one part of it. It's one of the three. We have a program of Alcoholics Anonymous which teaches me how to live. It taught me after steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 to go back and make some amends. Some amends, again, we do the best we can, and we make our amends. We walk through that process with a sponsor. And sometimes opportunities come up to make amends later on. I got thrown out of the Army from drinking, laid off. In 1984, I had an opportunity to go back and serve on active duty and finish out my retirement and serve honorably, sober. That was an amend. I look at that as an amend. And I didn't ask, you know, I just, God, if it's your will, I'd like that opportunity. And it came. So, we go through the amends process. And then the program teaches me how to live. It teaches me how to live life. I did not know how to live life. You know, I've heard it said we stop growing emotionally when we pick up drinking. And I didn't grow up emotionally before I picked up a drink, much less after. I was gone. I had no emotional stability whatsoever. Somewhat, slowly but slowly, I've been able to learn to get out of myself a little bit. You know, I can do things for my wife today. I can do things for my grandkids. I can do things for other people. I'm still not very good at it. I'm still intolerant. I'm still all kinds of things, but I'm a lot better than I used to be. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me how to live on a daily basis and how to try to get out of myself, try to do God's will. It says on page 77 in here, the real purpose, it says our real purpose, page 77, this is the first 100 people who put this book together, and what this program is. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Right there. That's our real purpose. God is paramount in my life today, and that's been good. Real briefly, I'll talk about I sponsor me. I got a second sponsor. He came in 1944. I lived over in Maryland. And he died in 97. But in 1984, 1987, I got transferred to Georgia. I did not get a sponsor in Georgia. I left Georgia and I got transferred to Germany. I did not get a sponsor in Germany. I spent 5 years over there. I came back to Germany and went back to Georgia, and I did not get a sponsor this time in Georgia. I didn't get a sponsor until I moved to Culpeper. I stayed active in meetings. I sponsored some people, but I didn't get a sponsor. I share that with you too. Don't do that. Don't do that. It was not good for my marriage. It was not good. I didn't take a drink. I had a sound foundation, but I did things that I didn't want to do. My thinking got off again because I stayed active with meetings, reasonably active, once a week. Not active like I am now, once a week. Don't do that. I share that. So I got a sponsor when I came to Culpeper, and I said, you know, I really need to reinvigorate myself in AA. And we have I have a home group, Saturday morning, any length group. We go through this book line by line, the first 164 pages, 7 a.m. And it's a good meeting, a very good meeting. A lot of people I see here show up at that meeting. So I share my mistakes because I think that's important. If you can stay with it, your life certainly goes much, much better. Now, a couple stories. I was maybe 4 or 5 years sober, and before I went back in the military, and I was in sales. And I got made this top club. And we had a sales conference in Hawaii. And if you don't believe there's a God or there's something going on that's bigger than me or you or any of us here, a couple of stories that bring this home to me. So, I go to this conference in Hawaii. It's 6,000 miles away. And it's a black tie affair. And we have assigned seating, so I don't know who's sitting next to me. My wife is here. I don't know all these other people. And we're going to have a toast to the president and a toast to everybody. A lot of retired militaries in there, and we're going to have all these toasts. And 400 people in this room. When they're coming around to serve, whether it was champagne or wine for the toast, I take my wine glass and I turn it upside down. I put my water glass in front of me. And the lady sitting next to me says, "You don't drink?" And I said, "No, I've got whatever I had, 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous." She said, "Oh my God, I've got 90 days and I didn't know what I was going to do here." You can't put two people 6,000 miles away sitting together like that, that she didn't want it, and God didn't put us together. I had nothing to do with that. I had nothing to do with it. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. My sister-in-law, my sister-in-law had gone underground. She had some little legal trouble, and she was gone underground. We hadn't heard from her for 10 years. And one of my daughters said, she's praying for Aunt Margie. I said, "Okay, I'll pray for her too." So I started praying for Aunt Margie. And I'm living down in Atlanta. And I belong to a flying bomber museum, a World War II bomber, that's based in Indianapolis. That bomber had flown to Oklahoma City to do an air show, and an engine went out. Nothing happened. I mean, nothing happened. No damage to anybody or anything. Just the engine had to be replaced, and they'd ordered one to come in, and they called me up, and they said, "Rich, can you fly up to Indianapolis, pick up another guy, and come out and help us put this engine on?" I'm a good pilot and a mechanic and all that stuff, and I said, "Sure." So I go pick up this guy, and we fly out there, and we get there about 7 o'clock at night, and we're not starting work that night, so there's about 10 of us, and we all go to this restaurant and have dinner, and he's up paying the bill. And I turn around, I'm standing there ready to go out the door about 10 at night, and I turn around, and there's my sister-in-law sitting there. And she was happy to be found. She was happy to be found. And so we were able to redevelop that relationship. So when I say prayers are powerful, you know, you can't make this stuff up. And, you know, I could go on and on. I made a couple of deals with God, back to my favorite bed. I made two deals with God early on, and it was really the third step. I said, God, I will do the best I can to fix Rich Dykes with these 12 steps, and you've got everything else. You've got my love life, you've got my job life, you've got everything else in my life. I truly gave it all up. And that you can make a deal with God as long as it's on His terms. That worked really well. As I said, I've been married to the same woman for 34 years. See, I can't orchestrate that. My thinking wouldn't do that. My actions wouldn't do that. You know? And certainly had success in many areas of my life, but peace of mind, serenity, all these things that this program gives us, happiness. I'll tell you what. You know, if it wasn't for happiness, if it wasn't for seeing happy people in AA, I would not want to be here. And I said that when I first came in. I said, you know what? If I'm going to be miserable, I may as well go back out and get drunk. I don't want to be miserable. I spent 29 years of my life being miserable, suicidal, and depressed, and I didn't want to spend another day that way. And that was another deal I made with God. I said, God, if I can help it. My mother, may she rest in peace, she didn't know what to do with us. You know, we were sick pups. She was an only child, older parents. And I never knew her to be happy or to be satisfied a day in her life. I never knew her. She died being a miserable, grumpy, unhappy person. When I got my master's degree, Bob Hope spoke at Loyola. I was teaching ROTC, and I got my master's degree. And my godparents were there, and my parents were there, and me and my wife. And we go in this nice seafood restaurant, and we're sitting there eating. And my godfather, he knew my mother well. He and my dad have been friends since they were elementary school. And my mother's grumbling the whole time. She's grumbling during the ceremony. She's grumbling the whole time because it's not about her. I'm not taking her inventory. This is where I came from. This is why I was like I was. And so the funny part of this story is we're sitting there, we finally get to the restaurant, she's still grumbling, and the food comes out, and she's grumbling about the food, she's grumbling about the restaurant. I mean, the whole night she's been grumbling. And my godfather sits there, and he's quick with it. He said, well, I got the same as you, and mine's delicious, and he swapped plates just like that. So, you know, that's where I came from, that kind of negativity. So when I made this deal with God that I would, if I could help it, I would never spend another day in my life being miserable, unhappy, suicidal, or depressed. I can tell you that certainly didn't work all the time, but it worked 99% of the time. You know, when I can't remember 1% of being happy in the old me, and now I can't remember 1% of being unhappy or being depressed or being whatever. And I know how to get out of it now. I know how to get out of it. The program teaches me how to get out of it. The program teaches me how to have thankfulness, how to have gratitude, you know. One of the other books I read early on was Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. I needed that. I needed to really retrain my brain to think more positively. So today I have a life second to none. I'm a happy alcoholic. I'm happy to be here. And one day at a time, in this 24-hour meditation book that we have, is a Sanskrit proverb in the front of that book. And it's something that's always been with me from the first time I read it. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lies all the realities and verities of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But each day well lived makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. And I thank you all for sharing it with me and for being part of my day today.